This is why we love racing in all its forms.
Max Delight shot through, grabbed the lead. Max Delight wins it.
The rail now for Zipping Rambo goes through in the Sandown Cup.
Very elegant. 10 Group 1s and now the greatest of them all, the Melbourne Cup.
For the next hour, RSN is cracking the codes.
Good morning to you as we crack the codes on this Saturday morning of Zipping Classic Day. We're hot off the heels of the Melbourne Cup at Sandown and also the Inter-Dominion starts Saturday night. So plenty of big racing coming up over the weekend, and there's only two-thirds of us here this week to crack the codes, Dan Malecki and myself. But good morning to you, Dan.
Good morning, Simone. Yes, Maddie, he's been pretty busy, though. We'll be able to catch up with him a little bit later on in the morning. But speaking of busy, there's a lot happening this weekend, isn't there? You mentioned the Zipping Classic, where we've got the Jericho Cup tomorrow. We've got a good night at Melton tonight on the back of Breeders' Crown last week, but the Inter-Dominion starts as well. There's great racing wherever you look. And at Caulfield today, it's not a new meeting, but it's a new date, because it used to be run at Sandown, and it's been put back 2 weeks. We've had regional race days, Ballarat Cup, Cranbourne in the last couple of weeks. So I think there's a number of punters that have been hanging out for a city class meeting, and the Zipping Classic, formerly known as the Sandown Classic, and even before then the Sandown Cup, it's been reshaped a bit, but it's very much associated with a great horse, Zipping, who won the event four times, which is quite remarkable. And I've plucked out one of his big wins that I remember so well. He took on a field of top-line horses and won the Turnbull.
Here's Shootout peeling to the outside of Zipping, and Typhoon Tracy's running on. Zabrasive's got right to the outside. Monaco Consul and Speed Gifted stay near the inside. Shocking trying to weave his way through the field at the 400 metres now. And here's Shootout and Zipping. They race to the lead together now. Getting through Faint Perfume, and Shocking's coming home, and Typhoon Tracy's joining in as well. It's Zipping, Shootout, Typhoon Tracy, Shocking the far side. Zipping and Shootout. Zipping continuing to kick. Zipping hanging on. The old boys got home. Zipping a neck to Shocking and Shootout, third every hope. Metal Bender charged to the line.
She was a field of stars. That was in 2010. So it just shows you how good Zipping was. Fourth in a Melbourne Cup, and four times he won the race today that's named in his honour.
Yeah, terrific effort indeed, isn't it, Dan? Four times. You can't believe that. It's a bit like Bold Trees winning the Sandown Cup 4 years in a row, and to have a horse win a race like that. We saw Maccabi Diva take out three Melbourne Cups, but very unusual to see one horse's name four times on the honour roll. Also tonight, Dan, the Inter-Dominion starts in Sydney, but at Melton, you'll be calling all the action. We have the Westburn Grand free-for-all, and wasn't he a terrific pacer as well?
He was so good. He could have done anything. He's one of the best pacers that I've ever seen. Any big race anywhere in Australia, he was able to win, and sometimes multiple times. And the tie-in, that is the Westburn Grand free-for-all at Melton tonight, but it's also the first night of the Inter-Dominion Carnival. It starts off at Menangle tonight, and of course Westburn Grand famously won the Inter-Dominion Grand Final at Moonee Valley in 1992.
Around the turn, 220 metres out, third quarter, 30.1. Westburn Grand is going well in front. He's held together by 2 metres to Blossom Lady. Master Musician pulls to the outside from Christo Avance. He goes to Westburn Grand at the 150. He's still 4 metres in front. Christo Avance and well back is making ground. Franco Tiger getting out with the Grand Circuit champion. Westburn Grand in front. He wins the Inter-Dominion. Westburn Grand wins by 2 metres to Franco Tiger.
Brian Markovic calling there, and I was there that night. I actually went out with Vic Frost later on and celebrated. It was a very memorable night for me, as well as it was for everyone involved with a great horse. And he was a great horse, without a shadow of a doubt.
We've got some great guests on the show too this morning, Dan. We've got Kate Gath a little later on.
Yeah, and it's fascinating when you hear what she did in the preparation before the Breeders' Crown weekend. So we'll have a good chat with Kate, and she's got some big things in store over the next couple of weeks, that's for sure. And one of the big events over the course of the weekend is the Jericho Cup. Simon Wilde trained the winner and also the consolation winner of last year's race, and he's about to join us. But before he does, let's relive the 2020 Jericho Cup.
Count Zero is 2 lengths in front. Will John can't peg him back. Then Dambula. Alienated's not looking so good for the each way all of a sudden. They're into the home straight now, and it's still Count Zero for Luke Stumpy Williams. This would be the biggest win of his career. He's been riding for 30 years. He's 4 lengths in front. Second placing is Tambula, then Will John. But Count Zero, he's going to do it. It will be one hell of a wild party, I tell you. He's won the consolation. Now he's won the Holmes Pace Jericho Cup. Count Zero, you beauty, in a like a Glenbos celebration, Stumpy. Five lengths, two Tambula, Will John. Alienated fourth.
And I'm sure our next guest on Cracking the Code would never tire of hearing that replay. An absolutely outstanding victory there to Count Zero in the 2020 Jericho Cup. And Simon Wilder, our next guest on Cracking the Codes, lines up on Sunday or tomorrow to do it all again and has two runners in the Jericho Cup. So good morning to you, Simon.
Good morning.
Great to have you on Cracking the Codes this morning. But gee, that call at the end there of Count Zero and also jockey Luke Williams, that must send a shiver down your spine, even though it was only 12 months ago.
Yeah, absolutely. It's quickly becoming quite a popular race down this way and in general, I think. And I've loved the concept from the start, and it was just a thrill to be a part of the race, be involved, and then to be able to win it was terrific. And I think it added a little bit with Stumpy being on the horse. He's got a bit of a story as well, and it was a very very memorable day.
Simon, I was going to say that the race history has only been short, only been a few years or so, but the history behind the concept is obviously going back a long time, and it resonates with a lot of people. How does it affect you? Where does that emotion come from? Because I know obviously all the Warrnambool team and a lot of key racing personnel have got it on their bucket list as a race to win now.
They certainly have, yeah. I think the very first year, I remember some clients of mine came down for the day, some owners, and they had the most wonderful day. And it was a different experience from the usual racetrack experience. Some of them were a bit older, and it did really resonate with them. And I just thought what a wonderful concept it is that we're commemorating a race that was run, over 100 years ago with, people that, put their life on the line for Australia. And just to be able to keep that memory alive by, commemorating it with a race at Warrnambool around a tricky sort of course. And, I just think it's got a really good niche sort of place in racing. You don't see it that much now. The real meaning behind it, I think's, you don't see it all that often. So I just think it's a fantastic concept. I think if people get to the races and experience the day, that's what it is. It's about experiencing the day, and you won't be disappointed because every person that's been, they just book it in the next year. They're coming back, and it's a real celebration. I think as time goes, I think the town will start to get behind it more and more, which they already have. I think there's some dinners on Saturday night for people to go to and there's speakers so I think it'll really gather some momentum. It's a great concept.
I think you're absolutely right, Simon. And when we think of racing in Warrnambool, we always think of the May Carnival, and it's steeped in history and tradition as well. But this race, the concept behind it, I think, like you mentioned, it resonates with so many different people. And we have so many pop-up races these days and races that there's a lot of prize money thrown about, and they're great. They're great as part of the racing landscape. But to have a race that actually has a meaning and it's been put on for a reason and there's a history behind it, I think that's what it resonates far further than just the racing public.
Yeah, that's right. I think also it appeals to a broader range of people. There's the May Carnival, you get the real hardened racing people that, they go midweek, they love to bet. I think, the Jericho Cup is more of it's a real family day. There's something for everyone. They parade the Whaler horses. There's history to be learnt. I had three great-grandfathers that all died in World War One, and this whole race has sparked my interest in the war and what some of the people went through. And I've obviously read the book Bill the Bastard, and I've read a lot more stuff and been a lot more aware about Australia's war history. And You know, I'm quite interested in it, and you just realise what people went through, you know, only 100 years ago. And I mean, I know we've been through a little bit recently, but we've been in a pandemic, but, you know, it really, you know, perspective wise, you look at what some of those young Australians went through, 100 years ago, and it pales into insignificance in what we've had to deal with in a pandemic. So, I think even for younger people, it's great to delve into that. Find out a little bit about it, and it's and that's what the race is about, the Jericho Cup. And as I said, they parade the whale of horses, and there's every race on the program, is named. I think the fillies and mares race is the Midnight. I forget the name of it, but it's to honour the mare Midnight.
Midnight Madness.
Yeah, there's
the
banjo Patterson. Yeah,
that's right. And I think if you delve into that, so if families go, you know, there's something there for everyone. You don't necessarily have to be a hardened punter to, you know, get something out of the day. So, yeah, look, I think I'd encourage anyone to go, you know, even as a group or a family, and I guarantee you won't be disappointed.
Yeah, look, the history component of it, it's important for generations that are down the line. I myself learned so much with some of the stories. You mentioned the Bill the Bastard story, and just the stories involving the whaler horses that were involved through the war. And it wasn't just the human casualty, it was also the equine casualty. They were equally, as heroic as well. And to celebrate it, but it's in memoriam, and we don't want to forget it. And to create this race, I love the way that... everybody, it seems, in horse racing has grasped that, Simon, and wanting to be a part of it, and not just winning it, but just having a runner in the race. It's not easy, but it's Australian New Zealand horses only. It just makes sense, and it seems to resonate, and I can see why it's so popular. And to have a crowd back this year as well is going to add to that.
It certainly will. I mean, it really has had its challenges in the first year. Well, the first year was just fantastic, and then then there was weather, and then we've had the pandemic as well. So, for it to be able to keep going and survive, which it, I'm not surprised it hasn't, but, it's had its challenges, and it, to come out the other side now, and I just think it'll grow and grow. And, Bill Gibbons' foresight in creating this race and sticking with the values of it, which, as you just mentioned, only making it open to Australian and New Zealand bred horses, I just think is absolutely wonderful. And then even the qualifying conditions to get into it, there's races all around Australia for horses to qualify, and even in New Zealand. And, it adds to it. We're thinking 12 months in advance about how we're going to get points, how we're going to get our horses in. You're right, Dan, like there was a lot of horses that did lose their lives in the war as well. And, there was some famous horses that... that did amazing things. So, being able to commemorate it in a race where horses are used and people from Australia and New Zealand, I think it's just, it's a wonderful thing. And this race will grow and grow and grow. And I think, it doesn't compete with May, which is fantastic. It's at a whole different time slot, and it's the weather's good, and I think it'll in years to come it'll be a pretty big event.
Simon, as a horse person, and look, I've got an off the tracker myself, and just a horse lover, have been all my life. When you look into the history of this, it's really it makes you quite emotional when you think of the horses. And I'm getting emotional now. You just think about the sacrifice that they made and how noble they are, and all the rest of it. It must be. I don't know, it must fill you with a sense of pride that you can get a horse to the track for that race. But how do you prepare them to run over 4,600 metres when you don't have a lot of races around, perhaps, that they're running over that distance? And how do you get a horse fit enough for that? And do you need a particular type of jockey that, can ride that length of time? Can you just give us an insight into the training of a horse to run in the Jericho Cup?
Yeah, look, we... as I said, it's nearly a 12-month plan. You've got to identify the horse first. They've got to be quite tractable to get around the course that turns in both directions. It's up and downhill. They go over roads with sand. So they've got to they've got to be a very tractable horse. They've got to be quite sound. And then they've got to have that staying prowess. And that's what we're trying to identify. And it is it's a bit of a process because it's not like you can get a horse, give it a few trials and run it in a, you know, like we do an 11 or 1200 metre race. It's, you know, it's more about conditioning. They do a lot of, you know, a lot of slow base work. So that can go on for, you know, even a couple of months to put that base work into them. And then you've got to, you know, consider getting points. And we are lucky in Victoria that we do cater for stays very well down here. So, you know, I've got two horses in the race this year and they're both coming off very different preparations. But, you know, Beachgoer's had a lot of runs. He's a horse that needs to have conditioning and races, which he's had. Our other horse, American in Paris, is, you know, he's a real natural stayer. So he's going into the race off just two runs and they've only been a 17 and a 2,000 metre race. So they do vary, but, you know, there is that planning and there is that base work that you really can't avoid. It's, you know, at some stage that's got to go into them. But, you know, it's quite an enjoyable process, you know, planning it and trying to get a horse there. And, you know, there's other races on the day too. There's the, you know, they often have the consolation, which the winner of that race is an automatic, gets an automatic entry into the Jericho the following year. And, you know, variants of races on the day. So it's, yeah, look, it's good, but it does take a little bit of planning to get one ready for the Jericho.
And the other thing, the horses are required to run around the two different directions, aren't they? They've got to run anti-clockwise and clockwise. Does that affect the preparation or the training, particularly in Victoria when the horses are always running anti-clockwise?
Yeah, it's something to consider. I think they do one trial day. People think they, you know, their horse needs to have a look at the hill component of the track and turn into the opposite, you know, turn the opposite direction. They do run trials, and I think it's dependent on the horse. You know, if you've got a horse that's perhaps, you know, been in a jumping race like our horse American in Paris, he's actually been up and over the hill in a steeplechase, so he's probably familiar with the course. The other horse hasn't, so you know, if they do a trial over the hill, he might be a good horse to actually put in the trial and give a look to going the opposite, you know, in the opposite direction. So yeah, it is. I mean, the fact that they're going a little bit slower, though, it does make it easier to sort of get around the course. It's, you know, 4,500 metres. So it's not like they're going at breakneck speed or anything. So the jockeys are all high weight riders or jumps jockeys. So they are familiar with sort of, you know, races over 2 miles plus. And they're a bit bigger and stronger to be able to get them around the course. So I think it, you know, it does work well that the race is only open to the high weight riders.
Yeah, look, well, it just opens it up so much for, you mentioned the riders, but even the horses, from a welfare perspective, the extra long-distance races that are around now, and, you know, from Moonee Valley, at one stage there, we very rarely had anything past 3,000 metres at Moonee Valley, which is relatively new in the last 20-odd years or so, Simon, but now it opens up not just the qualifying races, but there's a number of other genuinely staying races, and not just for the open class horses. Hence, opportunity for a longevity and the horse welfare in opening up options for those horses.
Absolutely, yeah. It's funny now, we get horses offered to us from New Zealand and even other states to come down here to race in those staying races. You know, people have identified that Victoria does cater really, really well. And you're right. I mean, there's 3,000 metre races regularly at Moonee Valley. You know, some of these races are popping up everywhere. And you know, the Jericho Cup qualifying races, you know, there was a 3,800 metre race at Ararat on Ararat Cup Day, you know, so, or a couple of weeks ago. So it's really, you know, it is good. And as I said, people from in other states around Australia recognise that in New Zealand. And, you know, we've had phone calls to say, look, can you take this horse? You know, we think he's a really a genuine stayer. We don't cater in our state as well as Victoria does. And we'd like him to race down in Victoria. So, we get those calls quite a bit, really. And, you know, it's great. I think people, you know, look, our Melbourne Cup is 2 miles. You know, some of our most famous, memorable races are over a distance. And, I think, you know, we've got away from that gradually over the years in trying to breed, you know, two-year-olds and speed. But, you know, there seems to be a sway back towards the stayers. And I hope, you know, hopefully that'll encourage a bit of breeding as well, you know, standing stallions that win over longer distances and stout mares, you know, instead of importing horses all the time. So I think it's great for the future of staying horses and staying races that we, you know, that we do cater really well for it.
It's the same in the greyhound, Simon. Over the years, you know, it was always breed for speed, and the big money was for the sprint races. And the big money is still there for the sprint races, but the staying races certainly do hold their own. And we're seeing, you know, the depths of staying greyhounds are getting better and better. And, you know, once upon a time, you may have only had two heats for a $100,000 race, and now you're getting a lot more. So it's, it definitely provides a better spectacle, I think, the staying races for any code. You just get a lot more happens in the races, doesn't it? So you've got horses that may be way back and they come to the lead and to the front, and the complex of the race can change so much when you're going over a bit more ground.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, I think there was a famous greyhound from down this way. Was it
Bold Trees? Yeah, Norm McCulloch. Yeah, for sure.
That's right. And I mean, it captured the imagination, and they still talk about that greyhound down here. And as far as I knew, it was a staying greyhound. So I don't know what it is about, you know, stayers, but they do seem to, you know, in all codes, don't they? They seem to sort of, you know, capture the imagination a bit, that stamina and grit and determination that you do see in a staying race. And I think it's great that, I mean, of course, we've got to, you know, be mindful that you know, the sprinters, there is good money, and we don't want to lose that either. But I just think it's great to have a balance of, you know, sprinters and stayers.
And, of course, just up the road at Terang, one of the greatest harness horses of all time, the great Gamelite, who was as tough a stayer as you'd ever come across. So there must be something in the waters down that way, I think, Simon. The race itself goes for about five and a half minutes. And when you think from an investment point of view, you get punters involved just to, you know, when in Rome, do as the Romans do. You want to have a little bit of a flutter and get involved. But when you think about it, a value for money, whether your horse wins or it doesn't, for 5.5 minutes there, I reckon you're getting a good run for your money.
You certainly are. I mean, you know, it's, as I said before, if you do get a great run for your money, you know, and things can change. You know, horses are travelling, and then, you know, some are dropping out, some look like they're struggling, but they might, you know, they might actually kick into gear over the last 800 metres. That, you know, things change in a staying race so drastically, and, you know, it's a good value for money concept, and even just the spectacle alone, you know, the turning both ways up and down hills, just like the Grand Annual is, you know, it's a wonderful spectacle. You don't have to have a really big investment on the race to enjoy the race. And, you know, I think you're right. I think, you know, if you have a small interest, get back, sit, you know, strap yourself in, get a good seat and watch the race. It's quite an exciting thing.
And certainly so much support, Dan and Simon, from the top trainers. You've got Kieran Maher, who'll be back on his home territory, won't he? And David Eustace, Henry Dwyer, yourself, Charlotte Littlefield heads down there. Amy McDonald, who we had on Cracking the Codes a little while back. Peter Lafferty, another local. Plenty of big names in the field. And when I'm looking at the weights there, like you mentioned before, Simon, 70 kilos. Gee, I could almost get a ride on a horse in this race. I mean, when you're used to seeing jockeys at 55 and 70 kilos, 65 kilos, I see what you mean. They are the more heavy weights. But I just think it's a wonderful concept. And I think that you're right. In years to come, the Jericho will be as big as the May Carnival. It might be in 20 years it's as big, but I think it's just going to grow legs every single year, and just respecting the fallen soldiers and the horses, and acknowledging the history and the achievements. I think it's just such a great thing for racing to unite people from all different walks of life, not just your punters.
Yeah, that's right. I think that's what it does. I think it engages the people that you know, might not be racing tragics, and I think that's what we want to do, and that hasn't happened, you know, I think for a long time in thoroughbred racing. I think engaging that sort of demographic that aren't, you know, that aren't just punters, that are more interested in perhaps, you know, the horses as well. And I think it's a great segue for that to say, hey, come, you know, come for a really good day at the races. You'll be entertained. you'll learn something and you can bring the family. What could be better than that? Celebrating some of our history as well. I think it's, look, it's big now, but I just think it'll continue to grow and, I'm right behind it. I think it's just a fantastic concept.
Yeah, no, I totally agree with you, and everyone we talk to thinks exactly the same way. Just an update on a couple of horses before we say goodbye, Simon. Obviously, Charlie Rose, she was stripped behind in the Melbourne Cup. She was at the vets for a little while. How's she progressing?
Yeah, really well, actually. She was stitched up. The stitches have all held. They've, been removed now, and the flap of skin has taken. So, things are looking really good. She, all didn't go quite right for her in the Melbourne Cup, but post race she's had terrific care from all the vets involved at the Werribee Vet Clinic, our local vets, and even the vets on race day at Flemington were just fantastic. And everything's gone absolutely to plan. We couldn't be happier. She's she just left the box yesterday, and she's gone into a small yard, and then she's continually bandaged, but I think probably by next week we might be able to get her out into the big paddock. She can have a well-earned rest, and we'll map some plans for her for next year.
You've got a pretty smart mare, Duchess of Dorset. When I think of her, I think of her, she must be a three-year-old filly, but she's actually a five-year-old. But the way she's come of age, there might be better things in store for her after she absolutely bolted in a Ballarat last week.
Yeah, she was terrific. She got a bad case of colic as a young horse, and Margaret Lucas, her owner, they spent a lot of money saving her, and I'm really glad they did, and that's the reason that she's hit the racetrack a bit later in life. But she's got some real upside. She's, I think she's stakes quality. She's got a terrific racing pattern. She begins really well from the gates, and then, you can sit her anywhere in a field. She can lead. She can sit fourth or fifth. That sort of goes a long way in sort of 12, 1400 metre races, which I think is what, she'll be sort of racing in those type of distances. So, she's really foolproof sound. She's only very small, very little horse, but she's got a really good motor, really, great constitution. And she's a wonderfully quiet, bomb-proof sort of horse. So, I think she'll have a good couple of seasons coming up.
Sounds like Wongoom could be, the Wongoom Handicap could be amongst some of the races listed for her come next year.
Yeah, it's funny you say that. Margaret Lucas would absolutely love to win a Wongoom, and she did suggest that after Ballarat. And I hadn't really thought of the Wongoom for a horse like her, but then thinking about it, down in the weights and, a strong run 1,200 metres, she probably is the right type of horse for that, especially this year. She'd be down in the weights a little bit, and as I said, Margaret would love to win a Wongoom, being on the committee here, or having been on the committee and a local. So she probably will be aimed in that direction, I think.
Sounds like a plan, Simon. Look, thanks for chatting us today about something that's really important, the Jericho Cup and the history and the build-up. You were part of it last year and successfully, and good luck. We hope you are again tomorrow.
Terrific. Thanks very much.
This is RSN Cracking the Codes.
Simone, we had a great night, Breeders' Crown Finals weekend, the Friday and the Saturday night. It is a big weekend, and it's the best Breeders' Crown that I've been a part of. It was quite an amazing night. Performances by horses were as good as you could ever see, and there were some absolute standouts for the night, both in the equine form and also in the human form. And in the human form, there's no doubt that Kate Gath was having a special night. Three Group 1 wins on the program, and she joins us this morning on Cracking the Codes. Have you come down from cloud nine yet, Kate, on an amazing night for you?
Oh, yeah. So it's probably sinking in a little bit now, but, when you're in the moment, you kind of don't realise it so much. It's probably when you reflect and look back that you realise it's a pretty big night.
Three Group 1s, they all drew the back row. I don't know if that had dawned on you initially. And two of them were barrier 13. So it was a number that was lucky for some, in particular you.
Yeah, look, I've sort of been lucky with that number once before when Caribbean Blaster won the Victoria Cup. He drew 13, and I was shattered that night when he drew there because I thought he had a genuine hope, but things worked out well for us from that draw. And the other night sort of was a little bit similar in that, you know, just a bit touchy. She was, well, she was just better than the horses she was against. So the draw with her really didn't bother me too much. And, you know, Catch a Wave, he was the best horse in that race. And, look, it's never easy to win from 13. So it's not like you go out there thinking you'll just win. But I was pretty lucky to be on two horses that were, you know, superior to their rivals. And that really helped me get them over the line.
Kate, with Catch a Wave, I know it was a very emotional win, excuse me, for Andy in particular and yourself, a horse that you train, obviously, and you drive. So that real connection there between the two of you, but an emotional win for Andy as far as the trainers, the owners go. But what about this horse? He's a little bit quirky, isn't he? And Dan was telling me earlier that prior to the race, he was... had to be chauffeured by the steward, and you're having a few difficulties with him. Did that put you off your game?
Oh yeah, look, it wasn't the nicest feeling. I was a little concerned because he never plays up that bad, and I sort of was had in the back of my head that maybe he's gonna not perform at his best because it's really unusual for him to carry on the way he did. I mean, in my 20 years of driving, I don't think I've ever had to have been chauffeured around the warm-up by the clerk of the course. So, you know, it wasn't the greatest feeling, and I did have doubts about the way he was going to perform. But, he put that to rest pretty quickly with his performance, and now he's out for a well-earned spell, which I think is most important for him, and hopefully he forgets about all those little things he's done on the racetrack and that haven't been so cooperative, and he can come back next time just a little bit more mature and a little bit more focused on the task at hand.
It was a worry. I mean, previously he'd been put out of the draw, not that he'd galloped before, but because he'd failed to circle in the score-up. Now, we heard Anthony Budd on Gatesbet on RSN last week saying it's a rule that's got to be looked at because it's not fair. There's nothing actually wrong with the horse. But the horse is penalised. He is put out of the draw. What sort of a difference does that... I mean, it's a big difference for being out of the draw, Kate, but for the horse not wanting to circle, is that because he doesn't like to go on his left rein? I'd say you'd probably have to circle left... motion, wouldn't you? But why does that happen, or is it just simply a quirk?
Yeah, look, he sort of did it at home as quite a young horse, and we got him out of it here pretty good. And his first two trials, he never did it. But you're right; it was generally just when he turned left, and he just didn't want to, come around when I wanted to steer him left at the start. And then it sort of just got. Yeah, he probably did it the once in about his first race start or second, and then once he did it once, he kind of got it in his head. But I agree with Anthony. I think, you know, the horse didn't interfere with any other horse in any time that he, you know, needed a little bit of help turning, and you still get put out the draw. So I do think it's a rule that probably does have to be looked at, because these horses aren't necessarily interfering with any other runner in the score up. It's just that they need someone to give them a push or guide them just to turn that last little bit. So, it is something that probably could be looked at, but I think we're about the only state that does it. But, you know, they are the rules, so you just abide by them. But, I feel like it's something that hopefully he'll get out of as he gets a little bit older. But, he can sort of turn himself around, because it's not ideal. You don't want to be out the draw in every race you're racing in. He has got good gate speed, so, you know, a good draw would be useful to him as well.
Do you think sometimes, Kate, we forget how young these horses actually are? I mean, you see the photo of you going across the line and the vision, and you've got this beautifully matured, muscly-looking horse that you would not think was running in a two-year-old final at the time. And I think physically and mentally, probably worlds apart for some of these horses. So, like you mentioned, going out for a spell and maybe just maturing mentally, it's a lot for them to contend with when you think about it. There's so much going on, and they're young horses, and particularly if they are colts. Do you think sometimes we expect a little bit too much, and we just forget that they're actually, you know, sometimes very immature in their mind?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, imagine, you know, you speak to sort of, you know, any vets and stuff, and, you know, they'll tell you physically they're immature as well. And, I mean, the riches are on it in the juvenile races, so you're kind of forced to have a crack at them. But there's no doubt, you know, their immaturity is, you know, level is, you know, you think of a two-year-old child or something like that. And as soon as he races, he will not play up one bit. So he will walk back. After the race the other night, he had his head over the gate so, you know, everyone in the crowd could pat him. And he just stood there like an absolute lamb. And even at home when he's got leaders, horses leading off him, he'll just stand there and he'll be good as gold. And I don't know if he gets a little bit, like, worked up before his race or anxious, but it's just before the race where he won't turn. And as soon as he's raced, you can do whatever you want with him. So I think you definitely made a great point there in that, you know, they are immature, a lot of horses. I mean, a lot of them, you know, their maturity is beyond their years as well, but we do ask a fair bit of these horses, and that's why I'm quite happy that he's going out for a spell now and he can just, you know, reset and hopefully, you know, mature a little bit.
For someone like yourself that you've said you've had, you know, over 20 years of driving experience, does an incident like that unnerve you at all? Does that get you off guard a little bit, or is it, you know exactly how to handle it? You know, you might not have been in that situation, but your experience and your confidence is enough?
Yeah, I think it is, you know. Not really. I think when you're on the track, you just really focus. You just get out there and you just focus on the job at hand. And so despite what he was, you know, causing me a bit of grief in the warm-up, I was just focused on, you know, making sure that the horse did, you know, score up. And he was really good scoring up, in part, thanks to the clerk of the course. He did a really good job with him. And he actually didn't even look like putting a foot wrong when he was circling with the clerk of the course's horse outside of him. He didn't even try to play up at all. So, you know, once we got him away and we were in the score up, you know, it was all systems go. And, yeah, like I said, it's not ideal in that you're like, oh, is this horse not going to perform at his best? That did cross my mind for the way he was carrying on. But you just focused on what you've got to do and you just really concentrate on that. So, you know, it's something that you sort of, yeah, you do have to be a little bit mentally tough, I think. You don't want the situation to get to you. Otherwise, you're more likely to make a mistake or pull the wrong rein. So, the experience I've had, I think, does help.
Well, it certainly added to the drama and the build-up. That was the two-year-old race, and the two-year-old races carry more prize money. I know you'd never won a two-year-old before, but you did the double. You won both of them, Kate, on Saturday night. And just with Catch a Wave, we're going to listen to the replay in just a second, but it was the chaperoning of the clerk of the course, Simone, for the horse to come on. He wouldn't come onto the track. And then for two laps, when we say chaperone, he actually, the clerk of the course shadowed Catch a Wave for two laps in his preliminaries, which must have been fantastic for you, Kate, because he literally was attached to your hip, wasn't he, the clerk of the course, for that six-minute period.
Yeah, and he needed to be because although once he got me onto the track, then I ended up on the infield and then was back on the track, and he warmed up two laps okay, and then he, I think the horse in front of him might have pulled up the top of the track to slow up, and I was literally going at half pace, and, you know, he just did a right-hand turn at the start, like towards the mobile, and then I sort of sent him on his way to tell him off a little bit, and then he did a left-hand turn, and then that's when he needed the clerk of the course to just be right up in his shoulder, just against him, just feeling him there, and once he had that horse next to him, it was like he sort of calmed down and was happy to have a friend out there just, you know, going around next to him, and it did make a big difference. But yeah, he was certainly on his worst behaviour, you know, in the preliminary, and yeah, I hope that doesn't occur again.
Well, I know we've picked the eyes through him and having his quirks, but there's one thing that is undeniable. This is one talented, freakish young horse, and this is the way he took out the two-year-old Colts and Geldings Breeders' Crown Final.
But it's Catch a Wave going for home. Off the back in 27.8. He got 2 metres on Flash Jimmy. They've raced away from Interest Free. But it's Catch a Wave opening right up now. He is the standout two-year-old, and he's charging clear. What a big win. Catch a Wave is won by a space. Brutally Handsome second. Tim's a trooper. Flash Jimmy was terrific.
It was a space. I think the fate for everyone was known before the turn, the way you cruised up. In contrast to the week before, Simone, the horse led last week, And from about the 900 to the 600, the horse hung in, the horse hung out. He did all these little tricks to keep Kate on her toes for that period. And the other night he come from behind of the field, and really, I couldn't pick a thing that he did wrong coming from behind there the other night, Kate.
Yeah, no, he didn't. He is much better in following. He sort of, he'll just follow, and he doesn't want to sort of stop and start at all, whereas when he's in front, he tends to occasionally just go to switch off a couple of times, which he doesn't do it at home, which is, it's surprising that he does it like he does at the races, because at home he's so good. But, yeah, I was sort of, you know, happy in a sense that he did have a second row draw, so he would follow, and I knew when he followed that he'd, you know, race pretty tractably. So that probably did, you know, work in his favour a little bit. But even when he pulled out, aside from wanting to get out of it a little bit, he was perfect, and we just couldn't fold him. And he did a really good job reeling off those last two quarters.
Allowed you to enjoy the ride for the last furlong, as you would have done with Just a Bit Touchy, who won the two-year-old fillies Trotters and was very impressive. You had the race won before the turn. And in Cypher, which I must admit, I don't know what your plan initially was, but there was plenty happening early, and all of a sudden here you are off the pegs, three wide and going forward. You know, that was an amazing drive. But I guess by that stage of the night, you'd won two group ones, you were in the zone, and whatever you were doing, it was turning into gold.
Yeah, you sort of have those nights where you've had a winner or two, and you sort of, you know, probably do drive in the zone a bit more, a little bit more confidently than if you've had a night where you feel that you just sort of can't do anything right. But initially, it was definitely my plan to stay on the fence, but that all changed very quickly. We just speed out wide and the one horse not being able to hold up, and it was pretty obvious not long after start that I needed to, you know, find a way to get off the fence to give my horse a chance to win the race, and we were able to do that. And then sort of seemed obvious to peel three wide early and get around them, and then Pentalonte was coming, so I thought, well, you know, she can sit, I'll be able to sit 1-1 following her, and you know, we'll be up there and hopefully be able to peel when we need to. But that all changed too very quickly when Pentalonte was out of control and it was just charging. And, you know, I don't think Cam Hart had too much, you know, he sort of couldn't hold her, and she was just charging around the field. And then she ran to the top and I was like, oh, damn it, I'm parked again. And you know, I thought it wasn't probably ideal, but I did get around them for nothing. And, you know, it worked out really well in the end. And she's a really good filly. Like, I knew she had an ounce of luck. She would, you know, be winning that race or going close to winning it. She's as good as any of them. She just hasn't had a good draw. And to do what she did the other night with the run that she had, it was pretty impressive. You know, Amore Vita looked like she had her measure, definitely, but in Cypher just wouldn't let her get her. And in fact, she pulled away on the line. So very good.
Kate, you had seven or eight drives on Saturday night, on a big, big night of racing. What sort of toll does it take on your body, and also mentally? You must just be exhausted at the end of the night, and you've still got to pack horses up, excuse me, and get them home and get up the next morning. What sort of toll does it take on you?
I think you get used to it. I don't think physically it doesn't take too much of a toll. It's probably, you know, if anything, it's more mentally, just that you know, you've got to drive in every race. Or I think I had nine the other night, and one was scratched, so I had nine instead of 10. But, you know, so you really got to be focused before you go out in every race on the form. And obviously you've done the form, but you just, when you've got nine drives sort of in a row, you just need to have a little refresher and have a quick look at it again before you hit the track, just so you know every runner. And, you know, you sort of have a little bit of a plan at hand, but you can never just go out there with one plan, obviously. Look at, you know, in Cypher's race, for instance. So the worst thing you can do is go out there with a plan A and nothing else, because you're odds on to make a mistake when it doesn't come off, and you're not prepared to sort of think, oh, you know, what do I need to do now? So, yeah, mentally it's probably more, you know, than physically. But, yeah, at the end of the night, you're pretty tired, but... despite that fact, my husband still dragged me out to Crown. So I was more tired on Sunday. I wasn't great on Sunday. So, yeah, it eventually took its toll, put it that way.
We'll talk about something that might have added to your physical and mental tiredness, Kate, although you would handle it better than the greater majority. Friday was the first night of the Breeders' Crown, and then, of course, the finals Saturday night. A lot of Group 2s, a lot of Group 3s Friday night, and a terrific night's racing. Now, to make it maybe more interesting for you, tell us what you did on Friday, letting our listeners know that you're a runner, a long-distance runner, and you've enjoyed doing that for quite some time now with your sights set on running a marathon. So tell us what your day on the Friday consisted of. This is the same day the first night of the Breeders' Crown was conducted, where you had about eight drives.
Yeah, so in training for my marathon, that was it was 3 weeks out from that weekend, Breeders' Crown weekend, and you sort of have to do a few fairly long runs, you know, in the lead up, but you probably don't want to do them any later than 3 weeks prior. You sort of want to start to taper your training off a little bit then, and I had to get a 36K run in, and I didn't want to leave it until the Sunday after Breeders' Crown in case I didn't make it or wasn't feeling well enough, which is a good thing because I definitely wouldn't have, and I really needed to get this run in. So Thursday I had Maryborough. I couldn't do it Thursday. I think it rained really bad on the Wednesday, and so it sort of got to Friday, and I thought I've got to get it in. So, so Friday afternoon before Melton, I ran the 36Ks and had a quick shower and then jumped in the car to head to Melton for, I think, seven or eight drives. And, my legs were aching, it's fair to say. It's actually pretty, it's not too bad, but it's more punishing on the body than what I thought it would be, than what I realised. So the legs were aching for the entire night at Melton in the sulky and standing up and sitting down, so it was a little bit they're in a little bit of pain Friday night, but I got the long run in, and that was the important thing. And Tango Tara got up in the Group 2 race as well. So all in all, it was a great day and night.
Oh, it was a great weekend. You'd done in the lead up in the previous few weeks a 30K, and then I think it was a 32K, and then you stepped it up to a 36K. So tell us about that. I'm imagining, depending on what speed you were wanting to run at, it's probably about 3 hours. Would that be right?
Yeah, it was. Around that time, or it was just a little bit under. But it's tough to find places to run because you don't really want to be stopping across a lot of roads for traffic. So on the Friday, I just ran up and down our road a lot of times. So our road is about where smack bang in the middle, and it's 3Ks to the end and 3Ks back and then 3Ks to the other end. So I thought mentally it would be good, brutally, to prepare myself for the marathon, just running up and down in a straight line. And we got it done. So it was kind of handy because I could just put a bit of water on the fence outside my house and grab it on the way past, because it's important to get a lot of fluids into you and drink and not get dehydrated. So it's been quite an ordeal for my friends and family. My dad drops water off to me when I'm running in Melton on my long run days and pulls up next to me with it so I can get that in on the way. So there's actually a fair bit to it that you need to do so you can, you know, not hurt your body too much. And Marie Cowdo is a really good friend of mine, and at Melton on the Friday night, she went to Water Gardens to Boost Juice to get me a protein shake in between races so I could get that in after my run. So there's all these people sort of invested in that, and they've been so good to me. Like, I can't thank them enough for helping me with my training. So hopefully I don't fail them and I can make it on the day.
Kate, in the notes that Dan's given me, he said that you like to listen to true crime podcasts when you're running. Does that inspire you to run faster, that there may be someone chasing you, particularly up your road? Like, it's you know, I mean, you've got the main road, but it's all bush around you.
I do run at night a fair bit too, when I can, and my sisters think I'm, you know, nuts listening to true crime. But I just find it really interesting, and you know, I do listen to music a bit, but generally more podcasts. They take up more time, so they're a little bit easier. But I did run in sections of Melton when I went on one of my long runs, and I ran down roads that I'd never been down, and they were virtually in the middle of nowhere. And I come across this guy on a bike that he didn't have any, you know, safety gear on or anything. And I was like, yeah, I hope he doesn't turn around. And then next thing, I come across this cordoned off bus with police tape that was just sitting there and it had police tape all around it. And I'm kind of like, where am I right now? I was almost about to turn my true crime podcast off at that moment. But then we reached back to civil ground and it was all good again. But yeah, that was an interesting run, that one.
The podcast, if you're running for about 2.75 hours, well, you would have the other day, but most of the others on the shorter trip. So say let's round it off to two and a half hours. That's a fair bit of listening. You'll get a few episodes in, I imagine.
Yeah, you do. And you sort of, when you're in the zone, you're sort of hard looking at your phone and switching over, to the next one or podcast as you're running, because you don't want to, slow down. Or I'm pretty competitive, so I don't like to, affect my time at all. And, it's something that definitely set challenges for myself and to try and do it in, a certain amount of time. But, it's fun. It's something that I've really enjoyed for a long time running, and it kind of mentally just feels really good after and kind of keeps me sane. And it's just sort of my time and free time, and I just love the being out in the fresh air. And it's something really important to me, so hopefully I can get the job done when the time comes.
Well, your first full marathon, I believe it's the Melbourne Marathon, which is Sunday the 12th of December. So you've had your build up, you've done your training, and I know you're pretty keen to impress as well. So that's only a couple of weeks away. So in part, you must be excited, because it's not something you can just decide to do at the last minute.
No, that's right. And it was originally scheduled for October, but because of COVID, they postponed it because, couldn't have people getting together at that stage. So I've had plenty of time to, get prepared. And like you said, it does involve a fair bit of training, which wasn't easy, with my job and fitting the time in. So, but I haven't sort of had a training. I've just sort of Googled it and followed a few people along the way. So hopefully I've, got the training under control and can, get the job done in a reasonable time come race day. So it is something that I'm really looking forward to, and it's a new challenge for myself and something, that I really want to do. And hopefully, I'm guessing I want to do another one after. So despite the fact my poor feet would say otherwise, I and toes.
Baby steps, Kate, baby steps. One marathon at a time.
That's it. I've got to get through this one first. But yeah, I'm really looking forward to it. So should be good.
And the finish too, I understand you come in and do a lap of the MCG, is that right?
Well, that's what the course was, previously. So I'm thinking, yeah, it's the same. And, hopefully it won't be too warm, because, like I said, it was going to be in October and now it's December. And running when it's really warm isn't that a whole lot of fun, and it can sort of, unlike horses, it can slow your time up. I don't run faster when it's hot, whereas, horses, the times are just off the clock, on the first few races when it's really warm. So I need to take a leaf out of their book, I think. But, yeah, hopefully it's not too warm. But it starts at 6 a.m. So, hey, we're in Melbourne, so it can't be that warm at that time, can it?
Well, I know so. Your husband, Andy, is a bit like me. He's a big fan of Seinfeld. And if Andy hasn't addressed it with you already, he will soon. There is an episode in Seinfeld where they've got this African runner coming over to run in the marathon. And he stays with Elaine. And she's supposed to organise the alarm clock to go off in time so he makes the marathon. But, of course, it doesn't work out so well. So just remind Andy of that and to make sure you don't sleep in.
I know. I don't think I'll get too much sleep the night before either, because, I think it's Melton, I'm assuming it's Melton. I haven't looked it up. So by the time the last race comes around and I, drive into the city, it's going to be a pretty early start. But, we'll get it done. But I must ask him about that Seinfeld episode, because he actually hasn't mentioned that. But he hasn't taken a whole lot of interest in my marathon, and I think he thinks I'm just a glutton for punishment. But we'll see. He's probably right.
No, I think it's fantastic. I can't believe you did that run, but obviously you can only do it when you're fit. And look, congratulations on a wonderful weekend. Three Group 1s on a big, big night, Kate. That's something to be very proud of. So well done to you, and good luck going forward, and particularly in the Melbourne Marathon. We're really interested. We might have a chat to you afterwards.
Oh, you're welcome. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, what a fantastic talent, isn't she, Simone? And great story there, and long hours pounding that road.
Yeah, certainly an inspiration to many, and I'm sure many of our listeners are wondering how she finds the time, Dan, with all those horses to work and drive, but it just goes to show if you've got a passion about something, you'll find the time, won't you? So all the best to Kate in the Melbourne Marathon on Sunday, December the 12th. And Dan, that brings us to the end of another crack in the codes, and hopefully our colleague Matt Stewart will be back next week with us.
I'm sure he will. I'll catch up with him a little bit later on this morning. But a lot to look forward to through the course of this weekend, Simone. And if you're happy too, I'd love for you to join me again next Saturday morning cracking the codes.
Will, without a doubt.